like to welcome everybody to the Cornhusker Roundup 13 marathon meeting. It says 11 on here, so. This is the preamble of Alcoholics Anonymous. Alcoholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other, that they may solve their common problem and help others to recover from alcoholism. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop drinking. There are no dues or fees for AA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. AA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution. Does not wish to engage in any controversy. Neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sober and to help other alcoholics to achieve sobriety. Let's see, we have coffee available across the hall in the other room for the 10 o'clock meeting. There are tapes of all marathon speakers will be available at the tape table during regular hours for $4 per tape. And tonight I have Sue is going to read part of chapter 5, followed by Terry reading the 12 traditions.
Good evening, everybody. My name is Sue, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Sue.
By the grace of God, the power of Alcoholics Anonymous, and a sponsor, I've been sober since August 11th, 1986. This is how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program, usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. There are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. If you have decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any lengths to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these, we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go, absolutely. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us, but there is one who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. One, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. Two, came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. Three, made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood him. Four, made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. Five, admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. Six, we're entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. Seven, humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Eight, made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. Nine, made direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. 10, continued to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood him, praying only for knowledge of his will for us and the power to carry that out. And 12, having had a spiritual awakening as the result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. Many of us exclaimed, "What an order. I can't go through with it." Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, the chapter of the agnostic, and our personal adventures before and after make clear three pertinent ideas. A, that we are alcoholic and could not manage our own lives. B, that probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. And C, that God could and would if he were sought. Thank you.
Hi, everyone. I'm Terry, alcoholic.
Hi, Terry.
These are the 12 traditions of AA.
One, our common welfare should come first. Personal recovery depends upon AA unity. Two, for our group purpose, there is but one ultimate authority, a loving God as he may express himself in our group conscience. Our leaders are but trusted servants. They do not govern. Three, the only requirement for AA membership is a desire to stop drinking. Four, each group should be autonomous, except in matters affecting other groups or AA as a whole. Five, each group has but one primary purpose, to carry its message to the alcoholic who still suffers. Six, an AA group ought never endorse, finance, or lend the AA name to any related facility, outside enterprise, lest problems of money, property, and prestige divert us from my primary purpose. Seven, every AA group ought to be fully self-supporting, declining outside contributions. Eight, Alcoholics Anonymous should remain forever non-professional, but our service centers may employ special workers. Nine, AA, as such, ought never be organized, but we may create service boards or committees directly responsible to those they serve. 11, 10, Alcoholics Anonymous has no opinion on outside issues, hence the AA name ought never be drawn into public controversy. 11, our public relations policy is based on attraction rather than promotion. We need always maintain personal anonymity at the level of press, radio, and films. 12, anonymity is the spiritual foundation of all of our traditions, ever reminding us to place principles before personalities. Thank you.
Thanks, Terry. Sue? Okay. Next we'll have our speaker, and that's Beverly D. from California.
Good evening, everyone. My name is Beverly Douglas, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Beverly.
And very proud to stand here before you tonight and tell you that I'm a sober woman alcoholic. This was the case about 28 years ago. I stood in a mental institution at that time, and I had been out on one of these little day trips they had let you out on occasionally if you've been on your good behavior. I see some grins. I know some of you have been there. And it was aboard a fishing boat this particular day, and they were serving a little booze aboard the boat. And needless to say, I was quite drunk by the time we all got back to the hospital that night. Now, we had a woman on our ward who was different than the rest of us, and she was a new patient. And she was being treated for something called alcoholism, and I'd never heard of it before. But anyway, when they finally allowed me to go back up on my floor in my ward, and I went to my room, she followed me into my room. And she looked over at me, and she said, Beverly, she said, I think you're an alcoholic. Well, now, I want you to know I have never been so insulted in my life. And I told her in no uncertain terms that she needn't lay her thing on me, that by God, I was crazy. You know, and the sad part of it was is that I really meant it. I had rather been called crazy than have been called whatever this thing was as an alcoholic. In fact, I was so insulted when I seen my own psych the next day. I told him what Lenore had to say about me, and I said, now, Dr. Valentine, what do you think about that? He looked at me, and he shook his head, and he said, no, Beverly. He said, I can't see where you have any problem with alcohol. He said, you can just learn to face reality. Well, hell, I had been facing it. I'd been drinking, you know, until they got me in there. That was my way of facing reality. And he said, you can just learn to cope with some of these problems you have. I can't see where you have any trouble with alcohol. Well, heck, he was a boss, and it sure sounded right to me. So I was to continue to drink for another 3.5 years. Now, as most of you can tell, I don't speak English, I speak Southern. And I come from a little town in Florida, and I had two older brothers. And I don't remember what particular occasion was, but I do remember we were sitting at the supper table, and Daddy had said to us kids, he said, when you're old enough to go to work where you can buy your own cigarettes and your own booze, he said, as far as I'm concerned, you're old enough to drink the smoke. Well, hell, needless to say, I went to work at a real early age. About that same time, a war came along. You know, I hear a lot of people... By the way, for you young people here, that was the Second World War, not the first one. I want to get that straight right off top here. I know I hear a lot of people saying they drank for a lot of reasons. I don't remember drinking for any particular reason. It was, you know, when that war came along, it was like the whole world just went on a party. And all I did was just join the party. Only thing was, is when the party was over, I never went home, you know. And would you believe I'm still a party girl? I'm still the first one there and the last one to leave. And I love it that way. I just don't drink today. But anyway, By the time I was 16, I was a blackout drinker. And I was also pregnant and married, just in that order. Now, in the days when I was growing up, nice girls just didn't do those things. Hell, today, I guess if you're going to get married, getting pregnant's a good a reason as any, you know. Either that or going on welfare the way they do out in California. But anyway, I did marry this young man. I lost that baby, too, by the way. And I was in this marriage. And, you know, as I told you, I was a blackout drinker. Would you believe me if I told you that I was almost 4 months pregnant before I even knew I'd been had? I kid you not. The way I found out was that I was doing waitress work at the time, and I was serving breakfast, and then I'd serve a breakfast, and then I'd go throw up, you know, and then I'd come back, and I'd serve another breakfast, and then I'd go throw up again. Well, the boss was standing over there watching the action, and he came over and informed me it wasn't too conducive for good business, and he suggested that I see a doctor. And I thought, well, I got the flu. You know, doesn't everybody on Monday morning, you know? And anyway, we had family doctors, so I went in to see him. And after he had finished, examining me, he said, I won't see you in my office, Beverly. And I said, sure, Dr. Moses. And I went on in his office when I dressed. And he sat back in this great big old oak chair of his that swiveled around. And he folded his arms, and he sat there, and he looked at me, and he leaned over the table, and he said, Beverly, you are pregnant. Well, now, I thought about that for a few minutes, and I just leaned over the table and looked him right smack in the eye, and I said, Dr. Moses, it can't be. I've never been with a man. Well, now, he thought about that for a few minutes. And he leaned back over that table, and he informed me I was not the second Virgin Mary. I was real sorry to hear that. Anyway, as I said, I did marry this young man, and it was a very bad drunken marriage. The doctors had told me, I went into him quite often, and I was either, you know, black eye or my nose sitting sidewise. It was one of those kind of marriages, you know, and he informed me. He said, Beverly, he said, you really ought to leave this man. He said, he's an habitual drunkard. And he said, it's going to get worse. It's not going to get better. He said, one of you's going to kill the other one of these days if you don't separate. Well, I had a new daughter by that time, and she was 6 weeks old about then. And Mama was nice enough. She had moved out to California, and she was also wise enough. She did not send me money. She sent me a one-way ticket. And I did what we here in Alcoholics Anonymous call a geographic. And I went out to California. In some circles, that's really known as unlawful flight to avoid prosecution. But we here in Alcoholics, we have a language of our own out here, and you got to stick around to kind of understand it. And anyway, I went out to stay with Mama. Now, one thing I'd learned in that marriage is you don't go to bed with a man first. You get married first. And I got to tell you, by the time my daughter was 4 years old, it had been a long, dry summer. I kid you not. And I decided she needed a father, and I needed a husband. And I met this nice, young Irish Catholic boy. Now, hell, we all know that all Irish Catholics are alcoholics. They're all here, right? Believe me when I tell you I married the only Irish Catholic boy in the world that didn't drink. This boy did not drink. And I got to tell you, I was in the throes of alcoholism by this time. And anyway, he came home from work. We had just been married less than a year, and he came home from work one night, and he looked down at me, and he said, Beverly, I love you very much, but he said, either you're going to have to give up this drinking, or I'm going to have to leave. Well, now, I said goodbye to Paul, and Mama and I were back together again. Now, you know, when you walk into AA meetings, you see a lot of cliches up on the walls, you know, like easy does it and first things first, you know, and those kind of things, and think. Well, I want you to know I was very familiar with cliches when I got here to Alcoholics Anonymous, because Mama used to say them when I was a kid, and one of hers was, if you don't succeed at first, you try again. So as I was coming out of my second marriage, Mama was coming out of her fourth one. Well, hell, Mama just didn't say cliche. She was like us. She lived them. She believed in them, you know. Well, anyway, we had just gotten home from work one night, and I put the baby to bed, and we were sitting in the living room, and Mama said to me, she said, you know, honey, she said, we ought to get ourselves some kind of a business to ensure Charlotte, my daughter, a more secure future. Well, it sounded like a terrific idea to me, and I had some money, and Mama had a credit rating, and so we did. We got a business, a liquor store, and the fun really began. Now, you see, by this time, I was really into the morning drink by now. And instead of the morning drink getting me well by this time, what it was doing is I was getting drunk all over again. And I really couldn't afford that because we had this liquor store and I had a home and you know, and I had this baby to take care of and raise and I was really in deep trouble, but I fell in love again about this time. Well, really what I was doing was falling in heat, but I didn't know that then. It was love to me. And this young man introduced me to a thing called the barley sandwich. I can see you don't know what a barley sandwich is. Honey, that's beer and tomato juice. And that way it sort of eased me right into the day. You're looking like it didn't taste good. I got to tell you, it didn't. Tasted like hell. But, you know, I didn't care what it tasted like. It worked. And that was all I was interested in, was did it work? Because by this time, alcohol was the only consistent thing I had going in my life. Jobs were coming and going, husbands were coming and going, friends were coming and going, but alcohol was consistent and it worked for me. And anyway, I married this young man. You notice that I married them all. You know, I kept him honest. And if it sounds like I got another little problem running around in here, I do. I'm going to talk about it in a little bit. But anyway, we had only been married just, maybe a year or so. I can't really remember how long it was. And I began to have some of the darndest, funniest symptoms you ever heard of. I remember I came home, I got up one morning to go to work. And I was making the bed, and the bed was wet. You know, as I was making it, the bed, I couldn't figure out what in the world was wrong. And I looked around, didn't see anything sitting there, no drinks, no coffee, no water, no nothing. And I walked on into the bathroom and to get dressed to go to work, and I looked in the mirror, and the water was just pouring out of my eyes. I thought, well, damn, that's funny. Now, I got to tell you, drunk or sober, two things have been my motivators. Drunk or sober, fear and pain will motivate me into taking some kind of an action. And when I seen that, it scared me. But you see, I still had a fixer. And so I went out to the bar and I poured myself a couple of hookers. For you young fellas here, that was not the two-legged kind. Hookers were shot glasses in my day. And, you know, and I drank a couple of them, and the water just shut off. I went on, got dressed, went on to work. Got home that afternoon from work, walked in the living room, and the pit of my stomach began to shake. And the next thing I knew, I was jumping all over the living room. I couldn't control myself. Scared the hell out of me. And I knew if I could just get to my fixer, I'd be okay. And I finally got myself turned in the right direction, and I hopped right on into that bar. Always had a bar in my home. And, you know, and I went to get a drink, and I was shaking so goddamn bad, like to just bit top right off the bottle. And I'm trying to pour it in the glass, and I can't get it in the glass. I broke the glass, you know. And I'm thinking, what can I do? Because I knew if I could just get one or two down, you know, I'd be okay. And finally, I spied a champagne glass. It was a great big champagne glass that I had gotten from the liquor store from one of the dealers there. And it was sitting over on that coffee table, and I finally hopped over to that thing and got that poured in there, at least part of it, got my old face down in there and slurped some of that stuff up, you know. And finally, I began to calm down a little bit, you know, and I finally got some more down me, and I began to calm down a little bit more, and I thought, my goddamn boy, what was that? You know, I've had the shakes before, but nothing like that. Went on in the kitchen, though I was feeling fine by this time, you know, and fixed dinner and just went on about my business. And the next thing I knew, a couple of days later, or whenever it was, within a short time, I laid down for a nap in the afternoon, and when I woke up, I was on the floor. And I had wet all over myself and had mucus all in my hair, and I was vaguely aware that this was not the first time something like this had happened to me. And I was scared, and I went into my bar, and I poured myself a couple of hookers, and the fear was still there. And I poured myself a couple more shots, and the fear was still there, so I did the only next thing I knew to do. I called the doctor, and they had me take a cab and come on in to see him. And it was there that they pronounced that I was having epileptic seizures and that I was in the midst of a nervous breakdown. And that's how I got to UCLA up on that fifth floor. And that's where the doctors told me that they didn't think I had a drinking problem, that I could just learn to straighten out my life and accept things as they were. Now, you and I both know that what I was having was alcoholic convulsions, VTs. I didn't know that then, and evidently they didn't either. Now, what I have since found out, since coming to you people, is that alcohol will induce the same exact symptoms of many mental, emotional, and physical illnesses. And if alcohol will induce them, and the reason I know this is because when I got here to y'all and stopped drinking, all these symptoms just magically disappeared. It's just been amazing, you know. But if they will induce the same symptoms, they will also cover up these symptoms. And our book tells us, it says, you know, if after being here for a while and sobering up, we still find that we have some problems in these areas, for God's sake, seek outside help. We are not doctors and we are not psychiatrists in here. And don't come to us, you know, and ask us what you should do, because some of us will tell you, you know, we'll kill you. Anyway, that was how I got up to UCLA. And as I said, it was another 3.5 years before I was to quit drinking. And I want to tell you about my moment of clarity. I had was sitting around waiting. My daughter was away for the weekend. I was living in the same home that I'm still living in today. And my husband that I was married to at that time was about 5 or 6 hours late getting home from work. And we girls know where all you guys are when you're late getting home from work. You're out with her, the one who understands you. Don't laugh, honey. Some of us were the ones who understood them. Ah, you betcha. Anyway, I had waited just about as long as I could. And I decided to fix myself a drink, and I'd only had one or two. You know how that goes. And here he come, you know, and he looked down at me. And he said, "You're drunk." And he said, "I'm not going to take you anywhere tonight." And with that, he just went on up into the bedroom and passed out. Now, I remember fixing myself another drink and walking up into the kitchen. And the kitchen faces the front window out the driveway. And I looked out that window, and there were two brand new cars sitting in that driveway. And I took my drink, and I walked home through my home. And it was a brand new home at that time, and newly decorated. You know, it was the kind of a home, if you opened up the book of the Better Homes and Gardens, you'd see one very similar to it in that book. And I walked on out into the backyard, and it was beautifully landscaped and well manicured. You know, it was the kind of a yard that belonged in a home that belonged in that book of the Better Homes and Gardens. And if you'd have seen us as a family, my daughter and my husband and myself, we were the kind of family that belonged in that yard that belonged to... in that book of the Better Homes and Gardens, because that's what we presented to the world, you know. And yet as I stood there in that yard that night, and I looked up and I cried out, "Why, God, why now, when I've got everything that I've always wanted, all those things, why do I want to die?" And I couldn't have told you that night, but tonight I can. You see, what good is all you've got, all those things, if there is no joy in them? And you see, alcohol had taken all of the joy out of my life. It had taken me into a living hell of which I could find no way out of. And I think that Christ said something like that when he said, "What profits a man who gains the world and then loses his very soul?" And you see, that's what had happened to me. I walked on back down into the rumpus room, and I fixed myself another drink. I needed my fixer by this time, you know. And it didn't help any. And I sat there and I held that glass in my hand and I looked at it, and for the first time in my life, I was totally aware that it was not the friends, the husbands, the neighbors, all those things, the jobs that I had always thought had caused my problems. It was the alcohol, and I was fully consciously aware of it. And at that very moment when I knew it was the alcohol, I knew that if I kept on drinking, I was going to die. And at that very same moment, I knew if I stopped drinking, I was going to die. Well, what the hell do you do if you can't drink anymore and you can't drink any less? You know, I did the only thing I knew to do. I killed myself. Now, I say that facetiously, and yet for me, I believe that that's what really happened. I woke up 3.5 days later in County General Hospital. And I got to tell you, County General Hospital is quite a ways from where I live. I say I woke up, hell, I came to. No alky ever wakes up. I had tubes out my nose, my throat, both arms, and both ankles. And the first thing that I could get out as I was trying to talk was, "Where am I?" You know. And I couldn't see. I couldn't turn my head or anything, but I could see over the top, and there was a policeman standing over in my doorway there. And he looked over at me, and he said, "You're in County General Hospital, lady." I said, "Well, how did I get here?" You know. And he walked over to the side of the bed, and he looked down at me. And he said, "Lady," he said, "committing suicide's against the law." Well, now, hell, I didn't know that. I might not have done it, you know. You know, I got to tell you, there's an alky out in our area, and he's sitting on the appellate court today since he's gotten sober. And he walked over to me after a meeting one night, and he said, Beverly, he said, I want to make one small correction in your talk. He said, committing suicide's not against the law, honey. It's attempting suicide that's against the law. That made a lot more sense, you know, when I come to think about it. Anyway, it was when I got well enough, my doctor had sent word that he wanted to see me. And so as soon as I was well, I went up there to see him. And he looked at me and he said, Beverly, he said, you need help and you need it desperately. And he said, I can't help you. And he said, here is the number of Alcoholics Anonymous. He said, will you call them? Well, now, I didn't say anything out loud, but I can sure tell you what I was thinking. You son of a gun. I've been coming to you for almost 3.5 years, as many as 3 times a week, at $60 a whack, have damn near drank myself to death, almost killed myself, and you got the nerve to sit there and tell me you can't help me? You know, I was a little upset. But anyway, I didn't say that. I said, yes, I will, sir, you know, and I took the telephone number, and I mind real well, at that time anyway. I went home, and I got my house all spiffied up, you know, and got myself all straightened up and cleaned up, and I called the number. Now, I don't know whether you called a central office or not, but that's what I did, and this is how mine went. The woman that answered the phone didn't ask me if I was an alcoholic, and I'm very grateful for that because I really didn't know what an alcoholic was. She said to me, honey, are you having a problem with alcohol? And I said, lady, I sure am, you know. And she said, well, are you drinking right now? Well, I looked around. I didn't see anything sitting close by. And I said, no, I don't think so, not right at the moment. And she said, can you hold on for a little while? I'd like to send some people out to talk to you. And I thought about that. And I said, well, if you'll make it quick. So they came out. Now, 2 women came to my home. And I couldn't hardly wait for these people to get there because I wanted to tell them all about that son of a bitch I was married to, and I knew they'd understand why I had to drink, right? Well, they came, and I want you to know that they were there for almost 2 hours. And all the time they were there, I never got to tell them anything. Every time I'd start talking about me, they'd start talking about themselves to each other. You talk about selfish and self-centered. I mean, they were it. Anyway, when they finished with their conversation, they got up to leave, and they got over to the door, and they turned around and looked at me as if I was some kind of an afterthought, and they said, oh, by the way, honey, you be dressed and ready to go. We're going to come by and take you to a meeting at 8 o'clock. I mean, they never even asked me if I wanted to go. Well, I was dressed, and they came, and we went. And from here on, I'm going to talk about what I have found in this book. And this is a book called Alcoholics Anonymous. This is a book written by alcoholics for alcoholics about alcoholism. It says that we have a common problem, alcoholism, and a common solution, abstinence. And then we have the 12 steps. Now, I'm not here to tell you what you should do. I'm only here telling you my story and the things that I had to do in order for me to stay sober. Well, I went to meetings with these women. They come by and they got me and we went. And one of the first things I heard was, get a sponsor. So I did. I got me a sponsor. And she was one of those kinds that says, thou shalt have no other gods before me. I mean, she was a whip. I kid you not, she was a whip. And I want to tell you, as most of you have who've got up here and identified yourself, that through the grace of God, this fellowship, and in spite of my sponsor, I stayed sober since 1965. What is it? I got about 2.5 weeks, I guess, till the 10th of September, and I'll be celebrating my 25th. Me and old Dick over there. Anyway, I'm going to meetings now, and I've got myself a sponsor. And the next thing I hear is, get a big book. Well, I don't know what the big book is, you know. They got a whole bunch of books sitting over there. So they tell me it's called Alcoholics Anonymous. So I did. I bought me a big book. And I brought it home, and I gave it the place of honor right in the middle of the coffee table, right in the middle of the living room. And I'd go to more meetings, and I'd hear, get pamphlets, take them home and read them. So I did. I got pamphlets, and I brought them home, and I read them, and I put them all around the big book there on that coffee table right in the middle of the living room, place of honor. And I'd go to more meetings, and I'd get more pamphlets, and I'd bring them home, and I'd put them on the end tables on each end of the couch. And I'd go to more meetings, and I'd get more pamphlets, and I'd bring them home, and I'd put them on the nightstand on his side of the bed. One day, my sponsor called me up. You know, she had told me when she first started having me meet her at meetings, and she said, let me tell you something, Beverly. She said, if anybody should call on you by mistake, she said, you tell them your name and your illness, and then you sit down and you shut up because that's all you know. So when she called me and said she was coming over to talk to me, that's exactly what she meant. She was going to come over and talk to me. I was not to talk to her unless she gave me her permission. Well, she got over at the house, and you know where she sat, right in the middle of that couch, right in the middle of that coffee table, right where my big book was. And she looked at it, and she looked down at me. I don't know, everybody was always looking down at me, you know. And she reached over, and she wiped the dust off of it. She handed it to me, and she said, here, honey, now read it. Well, now nobody had said read it. They just said buy it, you know. So I did. I started reading it. Now, I want you to know, you heard my husband, those of you who heard him talk. He talked about the first page and how it took him 3 months to learn about a page with nothing on it. He claims to have an IQ of 150. I claim that my comprehension is below average. Now, I knew right off the bat that this book, first page, was blank. I don't think he's so damn smart. She told me, she says, now, I want you to start reading that book. In fact, she reached over and she got a hold of it, and she wrote right in red letters on the front. This isn't my book. This is my mama's book. My mama had 5 years of sobriety just 3 days before she died, and I have taken over her book here. Anyway, she wrote right across there in red in my book, emergency page. And she says, now, Beverly, she said, when you go to meetings and you hear a woman talk, and she specified woman. I think she had a problem. She said, you get their name and their telephone number. And I did. I filled up that whole emergency pages with names and telephone numbers. And on the other side of that blank page, she said, when you're reading this book, she said, write the name of the page number and a little short synopsis about what you find in here that's important to you. That was another emergency page she had me do. And she looked over at me one time at a meeting we were at. And by the way, you know, it was a woman's stag meeting. You know, I got to tell you, she said to me, if you can imagine this, she said, Beverly, you look like a woman. And you dress like one. And occasionally you talk like one. She says, but I don't think you know what it is to be a woman. And I want you to go to some women's stag meetings. I looked at her and I said, Eunice, there is no way I'm going to go into those PTA meetings with those gossiping, backstabbing bitches. Y'all got some of those here too, huh? But she looked at me and she said, you go to a woman's stag meeting. Well, I went. And sure enough, in that PTA meeting, I found some gossiping, backstabbing bitches. But let me tell you, I also found some very warm, wonderful women who literally saved my life. Who literally saved my life. So, you know, I found that women really don't like women, a great many of us anyway, not all, when we first get here. Because we either are in competition with them, or we have learned not to trust them. But in Alcoholics Anonymous, as I said, you will find some gossiping women, but you will also find that the women here in AA are joined together in a common bond with a common solution, and you will find a lot of love and a lot of understanding and a lot of good fellowship. Anyway, I was at one of these PTA meetings where she was one of these days, and we were sitting around after the meeting, and how you are sometimes, you know, gossiping, but with concern and love. And I must have said something smart to her, you know, I gave her a smart answer, which I wasn't supposed to do. And she looked around at me and she said, let me tell you, so I think I threatened her with getting drunk. And she said, let me tell you something, Beverly. She said, if you decide to get drunk, I want you to know I'm not responsible for that. I said, well, you know, okay. And then we had a few more words and she walked away from the table and she stopped, you know, and she come back and she looked down at me. And she said, and by the way, I remember that you're suicidal, too, and I want you to know I'm not going to be responsible for that if you decide to commit suicide. Well, now, I'm a little angry by this time, and I looked up at her, and I said, well, by God, you're my sponsor. What the hell are you good for, then, you know? They got to be good for something. Well, she picked up my book, and she shook it right down in my face, hit me right across the bridge of the nose. I'd like to think she really didn't mean to do that. And she said, I'm responsible for helping you to learn what's in this book and how to apply it to your life. She said, that's what I'm responsible for. Well, I didn't have any argument with that. Anyway, by this time she had taught me, she said, Beverly, she said, dumb. I want you to get a good, firm, basic program. I want you making any major decisions for at least a year. And she said, in your case, she said, you're sicker than most. I want you to wait 3. I kid you not, that's what she told me. And she said, and I don't want you to get emotionally involved. And then she added a little addendum onto that. And she says, by the way, honey, she said, there is a clubhouse here in the valley, and it's called the Allenest. And she said, I want you to stay away from there because there's a bunch of dirty old men there helping women with their spiritual program. Can you imagine that? Y'all got some of those here, too? Good. Anyway, I had no problem with that because, you see, when I got here to you people, I was married. And when I'm married, I'm married. Now, when I'm single, that's something else. Well, 3 years finally come along, and I was in a bad situation in a bad marriage. And I knew that I was either going to have to get out of the marriage or end up back on the juice again. And so I made my decision, because she had said that I had was old enough now in the program to make a decision of my own, and I left. And I left because I was filled with fear. I was scared to death that if I stayed with this man, I was going to end up drunk again, because it wasn't just the fact that he drank. I'd have made a real good Al-Anon, you know, but he was a womanizer. And I had been sober long enough by this time to have gained a little self-worth. And, you know, when we get rid of self-righteousness, we do get a little self-worth. You know, when we find that our way is not the only way. But anyway, I decided that the divorce was what I had to get. And, God, you know where I headed when I got that divorce. Sure I did. I was right straight over to the Allenest. I couldn't hardly wait to get there. I was just like a little kid in the candy store, and I said, I'll have him, and him, boy, you know. And right away, I knew I was in trouble again. I was in heat again. And I was scared to death that I was going to end up back on the juice. Scared to death. Now, I talk about this because I don't think that it's talked about enough. We lose more people out of Alcoholics Anonymous behind, quote, relationships. God, I want to throw up every time I hear the word. Than anything else here. And if you think that your sobriety is contingent upon your emotional stability, you're going to be in for one hell of a ride. I'm here to tell you. It is not. Our book tells us that a lack of power is our dilemma. And to find this power greater than ourself is exactly what this book is all about. All about. Now, I know some of you didn't hear me say that, especially some of you younger ones. If you're in heat, that is. So watch my lips. I'm going to repeat it, okay? A lack of power is our dilemma. And to find this power greater than ourself that will solve our problem is exactly what this book is all about. Now, it uses words like exactly, precisely, absolutely, specifically, and on top of that, it goes on to say it gives clear-cut directions. I mean, that really does not leave any room for the fertile imagination of an alky to run around in. It's got you by the... Boy, I mean, you know, right there, it's got you. You do know what it's got you by. Good. Good. And I knew I was in trouble. I knew I was in trouble, and I have found out I don't care whether you're 60 or 96, when you walk through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you got two problems, and that's bad breath and a broken heart. Booze and sex in plain language. And I do like to speak in plain language because I don't want anybody to misunderstand what I'm saying here, okay? Now, you know, I know y'all got some gurus around here, haven't you? I know there was one over at that tape table over there. Got any more around here? I got one sitting down there, too. Yeah. Any more? Sure you have. Okay, you young fellas, when you come in, if you got one of these gurus as your sponsor, I know one of the first things that they have told you is to stay away from the women for a little while because behind every slip there's a skirt, right? They told you this? Don't you sit over there and laugh, honey, because behind every slipper there's a zipper, too, I'll tell you. God, boy, I kid you not. And I knew I was in trouble. Oh, Lord, I knew I was in trouble. And I didn't quite know what to do about it, you know. You know, I got to tell you this little joke. And bear with me. There was this little doggy, and he lived with his family that lived by a railroad track. And he woke up this one morning, and it was a beautiful spring day outside, and he wanted to go play. And he scratched on the door and let out a couple of yips, and his owner come and opened up the door for him, and he ran up on this little hill here where the railroad track was, you know. And he was running along the railroad track, and he was sniffing at the weeds, you know, sniffing at the flowers, and his little ears were flopping back in the wind, you know, and he was just having the most glorious time. And a train come along and cut off a little tiny wee piece of his tail. And he let out a yip, and he turned around to see what that little tiny piece of tail. And a train come along from the other direction and cut off his head. Now, honey, don't you be like that little dog and lose your head over a little tiny piece of tail, okay? God, it's so true, isn't it? Anyway, I'm in trouble, and I know I got to do something. So I do what the book tells me to do. I write out an inventory because, you know, I'm 39 years old. I'm a three-time loser, and I'm an alcoholic. Now, I knew what it was to be married and be sober, but I didn't know what it was like, you know, my program to be single and sober. And so I went and I took this inventory on... where I was, you know, because I couldn't be all right. I'd had three of them. So something was wrong, even though I felt I was a good wife, and I was a faithful wife, and I was a loyal wife, and I was a hard-drinking wife. There was something wrong somewhere, and I had to find out what it was. And I took this inventory, and this is what I come up with. He had charm, polish, and prestige. After all, that's only befitting. We girls deserve that. You betcha we do. He was fun-loving. He was good-looking, hard-drinking, party-going. God damn, what a challenge and woman-chasing. And I got him. Ooh, damn near killed me, but I got him. And you know when we get him, we ain't going to let go of him. I don't care if they kill us or not. We ain't going to let go. Because we know the minute we let go of you, she's going to get you. And when she gets you, you're going to... all that potential is going to come out that we've seen there, and you're going to turn into a non-drinker and a loyal, hard-working, faithful husband, right? No. And you guys need looking grand because I don't see y'all doing any better. I see you doing the same darn thing. But I could begin to see what page 62 was talking about, and that was the one page in the book that I never identified with. It says selfishness and self-centeredness is the root of a problem. It says the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Can you imagine that? It says we alcoholics must get rid of that selfishness. We must, or it kills us. God makes that possible. Now, I don't know about you, but that scared the hell out of me when I read it. And I knew I had to do something. You know, I was sitting up at this L&S clubhouse one day, and I was expounding on how submissive and subservient I was. And the reason I use these words is because my mom and my daughter had looked me up in the dictionary. And, you know, and the kind of a person I was. And I think somebody here today or this weekend has used the word Pollyanna, you know. And anyway, I was expounding on how submissive and subservient I was to this ex-husband. And there was a young man sitting in the meeting there that day.
And he couldn't hardly wait for me to shut up because he had something important to say. And when I finished talking, he did. He got up and he pointed his finger over at me and he said, "Lady," he said, "did you ever stop to think that all you ever really was just a kiss ass?" Well, now, he hurt my feelings. And beside that, he took all the glamour out of being submissive and subservient. But I got even with him. I married him almost 19 years ago. So you men watch out, because we women do have a way of getting even. We're patient, but we get there. Anyway, I know I had to do something, and I didn't know what to do. But you see, I had remembered something that I had read when I was a child. And it was in this book that's not approved by conference. And to the best of my memory, it went something like this. I have created man in my image. And for man, I have created woman. And woman is to follow man. And I thought, I've done that. I followed three of you son of a guns, and look where I ended up at. The Nut House and Alcoholics Anonymous. There was something wrong somewhere, you know. And I couldn't quite figure out what it was. So I got back in that book, and I looked it up. And sure enough, I found it in two places. And it said what I thought it said. I have created man in my image, and for man I have made woman as a helpmeet. And woman is to follow man, and man follows God. And you see, it had never once occurred to me to follow a man who followed God. I had never finished reading the instructions. The story of my life, you know. Anyway, here I am. I've taken this inventory. I'm beginning to understand then what's the matter. And you know, I went to my book because my sponsor had told me, you know, I was always very, very upset. Have you ever just got so upset, you know, and just flying up your own ass? And called your sponsor. You have, good. I'm glad I'm not the only one. And called your sponsor, you know, and they listened to you prattle on, you know, for about 2 minutes, if they're a good sponsor. And then they say something like this. They cut you off right in the midstream, and they say something like this. Read the book, honey. The answer's in the book. If you have them do that to you, you just want to let them have it, you know. So anyway, I got back in the book, and I opened it up to my emergency page because I didn't have much time to think about it, I'll tell you. So I opened it to my emergency page to look to see where I could find my problem, and you know where my problem was. First number I had in my book, page 69. I couldn't believe it. It was a dirty book. Well, that was the problem, but where was the solution? So I turned the page over to page 70, no pun intended there. And on page 70, it gave me my answer to my problem. And the book has the answers. It really does. And it says, if we are truly sorry for what we have done and have asked God to take us on to better things, we believe we will have been forgiven and will have learned our lessons. But if we are not sorry and our conduct continues to hurt others, we are quite sure to drink again. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our own experiences. One more time, I was scared, and I knew I had to do something, and I wasn't quite sure what it was. Well, I knew one thing I had to do after I'd done that inventory was to go in then and talk to my sponsor about these things. And I went to my sponsor, you know, and I didn't know exactly what to do because, you know, I got to tell you, women, I don't care if you have been the biggest streetwalker, lady of the evening, like I was this afternoon. Did you ever notice on our program, it had ladies of the afternoon on it yesterday when I was speaking? I couldn't believe it, but at least that was a step up. It used to be ladies of the evening, you know. But anyway, here I am. And I don't care where you come from out there. When you walk in through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous, you are reborn. And if you don't believe me, you watch these men watching these newcomer women. They can't hardly wait to be the first one, you know. And they really believe they're going to be the first one. When you men start getting better is when you want to love the hell out of these women here, not the hell that's in them. When your program is really going to improve is when you want to be the last one in these women's lives, not the first one. That's going to be real improvement in your program. And you know something else I have found out since I have been here? I've had the privilege of holding some of you men in my arms since my husband is on the program, too. As you've cried over some of these affairs that you've been practicing your principles in, you know. And girls, you know, I used to think that it was always poor little old Nell who was so abused, and she was the one that was always hurt. Well, I'm here to tell you, if that's the way you think, it's not true. These men do hurt, and they do have feelings, and they do cry. So let's us try to be as kind and as honest and as understanding with them as we hope that they'll be with us. I think that's only fair. Yeah. You bet. You bet. Anyway, as I said, I knew I had to do something. I knew I had to go to my sponsor and talk to my sponsor, and I didn't want to. But you see, by this time, by the time I had gotten to my fifth step, it had told me that I had to tell somebody all of my life story, omitting nothing, all of it. For if I didn't, I may not overcome drinking. And then it went on to say that almost invariably we drank again. Now, I don't know about you, but that scared the hell out of me one more time. And I knew that I had to go to this sponsor, and I didn't trust her. And I knew she was going to come back and tell y'all what I had told her, and then you were going to ask me to leave AA. But one more time, I went back in my book looking for the answer, and let me tell you what I found in there. It says, cling to the thought that in God's hands, our darkest past is the greatest possession we have. For it is the key to life and happiness. And with that key, we avert death and misery for others. God, can you believe that? I want to tell you how that came about in my life. You see, I didn't trust her, but I had come to believe in and trust in God. And with this trust, I went to my sponsor and I told her all of my life story. And she shared a part of hers with me. And we developed a relationship. And it became a relationship of love. And as I then began to sponsor other women, and they shared their story with me, I shared a part of mine with them. And we also developed a relationship. And in most cases, it also became a relationship of love. And isn't love God? And isn't God spiritual? And isn't that what the whole program of Alcoholics Anonymous all about? A lack of power is our dilemma. And to find this power greater than ourselves that will solve our problem is exactly what this book is all about. Now, I came in here thinking I could get emotionally well. And as my husband has told you, I'm not emotionally well yet. Don't plan on ever being. I'm having too much fun this way. Okay? If it's bothering him, let him do something about it. It's not bothering me at all. I'm having a wonderful time. I came in here thinking I'd get emotionally well and everything was going to be okay. And I'm here to tell you that, you know, if you're planning on it, it's not going to work. I come in here thinking now that I was sober, I was going to be immune from life's problems. If that's what you're thinking, I'm here to tell you. It's not so. I want to wish for each and every one of you all of the things that I have found. All of the anger and the frustration. All of the joy and the happiness. All of the sorrow, all of the peace. Because you see, when our defects of characters are removed, what's left? What's left? Love, true love, peace, and harmony. And you see, I have found all of these things right here in Alcoholics Anonymous with you. Thank you very much.